This is the current federal tax developments here for the week of June the 20th, 2016. Current federal tax developments, as always, is brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated. We usually take a look at this, and this week our title is going to be Consistency Becomes a Hobgoblin of Tax Issues This Week. Current federal tax developments, again, from your State CPA Society's Nichols Patrick. This week, we're going to look at a few cases. First thing is a taxpayer discovers this duty of consistency that required one more year of wrong reporting by the taxpayer. The IRS issues details about how to obtain a refund of taxes on wrongful incarceration damages that was issued as part of the PATH Act. The IRS National Office this week discusses issues that related to success-based safe harbor for acquisitions and what happens when we have an acquisition of an S corporation with a 338H10 election, how that works into it. We find the tax court disagrees with the IRS about whether a transfer was incident to a divorce. We have an LLC operating agreement that boilerplate language began to that actually did disqualify it as an S corporation. And the tax court, we discover, ending on consistency again, believes that it's going to stay consistent in its view that a tax preparer's fraud will cause the tax return of the taxpayer, who may not have been aware of the fraud, to be a fraudulent return for purposes of the statute of limitations, all of which is something that effectively was the court of the Federal Circuit Court had ruled in a case appealed from the Federal Court of Claims was a ridiculous standard in at least the view of one judge on the panel. And the tax court said, ridiculous or not, we're sticking with it because we are going to be consistent about this. Well, we're back again into the CPE season. I want to remind you of a few things coming up for those of you in the right location here for this week. Butch Rogers is going to be coming up here very shortly on the 29th and 30th in New Mexico. Pair of courses that deal with oil and gas. In Albuquerque, we'll have oil and gas nuts and bolts, the basics. And then in Roswell, he'll have the advanced issues and updates course, both of which come here at the end of June in New Mexico. So if you're in New Mexico and you work with oil and gas issues, this is a set of courses you'll probably want to consider picking up on. In addition, if you are in Michigan, Butch Rogers on the 24th, he will also be there, and he's going to be teaching there church and minister taxation. That's a unique area. So if you're in Troy and you want to pick that up, that can be very useful for you. Finally, Bob Gilwee will be in Verhees, New Jersey. He's going to be doing on June the 29th, navigating divorce, tax, and litigation issues. And on the 30th, red flag issues, areas the IRS attacks in examination. So if you're in New Mexico, Michigan, or New Jersey, we have some courses coming up here very shortly that may be of interest to you. Now, let's start out with our first case of the week, and this is Squarey et al. Versus Commissioner. Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2016-116 issued on June the 15th. Now, this is a case that deals with a concept that is the duty of consistency. In this particular case, the taxpayer had effectively appeared to hold every check he received in the fourth quarter. This was an S corporation. Held every check it received in the fourth quarter of a year and deposited that check in January. The taxpayer was on the cash basis of accounting. So as you might expect, there were some large deposits in January. Not surprisingly, when the IRS examined this S-Corp and discovered this, tax planning technique, they weren't terribly thrilled with the technique. And in fact, what the IRS did was said, okay, taxpayer, those checks you are depositing from those checks that you received by the end of December, taxpayer, you got to pick those up. You can't ignore those and treat them as if they were not part of income. So the IRS says you got to pick up those checks, and they go for all 3 years that are still open. But 2009 was the first year under exam, and so there's a little problem here for the service. Because in 2009, in January, they picked up checks that were received in 2008, but they deposited them in 2009. So the taxpayer said, well, wait, IRS, to be consistent, we should, you know, to be consistent with what you want us to do, those 2008 checks should be taken out. And since, we should have paid tax in 2008 on them, but we didn't, well, they're just never going to be subject to tax. Not surprisingly, the IRS doesn't believe that is an appropriate result. And so the IRS came back and said, no, we believe you have to pick up that 2008, those 2008 checks in 2009 under the concept of the duty of consistency. The tax court took a look at the IRS's view here and effectively agreed with it. The court held that generally for the duty of consistency to apply, this case is appealable to the Ninth Circuit. There has to be three things: a representation or report by the taxpayer, a reliance by this representation by the commissioner, and an attempt by the taxpayer after the statute is run to change their position. In this case, the taxpayers argued, although they made a representation, they had done so consistently, and they argued that based on the case of Rivers versus Commissioner from 1968, that they should not have to pick up the income this year. The tax court in this case said, no, Rivers was different. In the Rivers case, the taxpayer, we had an installment basis issue, and the taxpayer had simply not picked up any income from the gain on sale from the installment sale. The IRS was attempting to say, well, you know, we want you to go ahead and treat every payment prior to this year as if it was directly a recovery of basis in the installment obligation, and we'll pick up the rest of the gain going forward. And the tax court said no. The court said and pointed out in this case, they said that taxpayer hadn't really had a position whatsoever. You had a position in this case, and you're trying to dodge paying. So even though it's not correct to pick up those 2008 checks in 2009, because you told the IRS they were not taxable in 2008, that you hadn't received them when in fact you had, that was a representation that's inconsistent. And because of that inconsistent representation, you have to have at least one more year where you're going to report that last 2008 distribution has to be reported by you on the 2009 return, despite the fact that that is now, shall we say, a wrong reporting. One last time wrong, and then we continue. Speaking of wrong, the IRS put out an Internal Revenue news release, IR 2016-88, their news release. They gave us procedures for how to deal with the recovery of taxes paid on damages received for wrongful incarceration. You may remember part of the PATH Act added a provision that held that if a taxpayer received payments for wrongful incarceration, those are not considered taxable. And in fact, the Congress said that for the next year, we are not even going to worry about the statute of limitations. So if somebody had paid tax on damages received for wrongful incarceration in 1982, they can effectively file a claim for refund today and receive back the tax money that they paid in 1982. Little caveat there, assuming you can figure out what exactly you did in the 82 return and you still have it. But nevertheless, the recovery is available. In this particular news release and a set of frequently asked questions related to this provision on the website, the IRS outlines how to go ahead and file the claim. So this is one of those things where Congress decided, well, it's not fair if someone has been convicted of a crime, spent time in jail, and then it's discovered later they didn't actually commit the crime and they receive a civil award, we're not going to tax it. So now the IRS comes back and says, okay, here's what you need to do to file this claim. Now, the first thing you've got to have is a proper covered offense. That is any criminal offense under federal or state law, and it means it's someone who was convicted of one of those offenses and who served all or part of a sentence of imprisonment relating to that covered offense, and who was pardoned, granted clemency, or granted amnesty for that covered offense because the individual was innocent of that offense, or the following two things are true: the judgment of conviction for the covered offense was reversed or vacated, and for whom the indictment, information, or other accusatory instrument for the covered offense was dismissed, or who was found not guilty at a new trial. If either of those are true, you receive damages later related to that, you have the exclusion. There is a special address the IRS has provided to send this to in Kansas City, where these notices should be sent, as well as information regarding how you label such a claim. The one-year period for filing a claim for refund without worrying about a statute of limitation runs through Monday, December 19th of 2016. So if you have a client or know somebody who has this problem, you want to make sure it gets filed by then. If it's not within the past 3 years, so that we can get the claim for refund processed and not worry about the statute of limitations. And the IRS has all those things. The IRS does point out a couple of facts here that are important. The rule does not apply if the person was arrested for something in prison but never convicted. So they, you know, we had a trial, they're found innocent. If they got damages for that, tough luck. That doesn't qualify for exclusion, though Section 104 may provide some options for physical, to the extent it relates to physical injuries that related during that period. And also, any claims paid to other individuals, like a spouse or child, for such damages is also not covered by this bill. So as the Congress said, as the IRS said, you know, this is not a perfect solution for everything. It's not going to mean that all damages related to such to some sort of imprisonment qualify. It's still got to meet all the requirements that we have on this particular issue. So basically, we got to be a little bit careful to make sure that a client qualifies. Not everybody will. Next up, we have Chief Counsel Advice 2016-24021. This looked at a case of a 338H10 target. 338H10 is when you have an acquisition of stock by a purchasing corporation, and the corporation is either a subsidiary of a parent, or the case we most often see is an S corporation. And if a 338H10 election is agreed to by the parties, it is deemed that the target corporation sold all of its assets and effectively liquidated the day before the acquisition, and then the purchasing entity gets treated as if they bought assets rather than stock. That allows a step up in basis, you know, all kinds of nice things for the buyer. The question here became, under Revenue Procedure 2011-29, you know, you incur expenses when we're talking about something or somebody being acquired. And sometimes these expenses only, you know, are only going to be triggered. You're going to pay a fee only if the acquisition goes through. So this is called a success-based fee. Under the regulations for the capitalization of items that are considered to be intangible items, which this would be an intangible benefit from the acquisition, you have to capitalize that intangible if it relates to a success-based fee, unless you can show that, in fact, the fee, you know, the item does not directly relate, did not facilitate the transaction, because facilitative fees have to be capitalized. Under the revenue procedure here, 2011-29, the IRS has provided that if you qualify, you can simply elect, rather than going through and having to document which of your fees qualify for this and which don't, you can simply treat it as 70% as if it was related, not related to facilitating the transaction, and 30% as if it did. Now, in this case, the S corporation, and we don't know if it was an S, it was either an S or a sub, but let's say S corporation, that was being acquired, made the election. They had some success-based, they had some fees in there that would qualify as this sort of success-based fees. They went ahead and said, you know what? We want to go ahead and use this 70% safe harbor rather than having to make all these, then rather than having to worry about all of these records that we might have to keep to prove that it wasn't related, did not facilitate the transaction. The chief counsel advice ruled that, well, that's fine, except Revenue Proc 2011-29 only works for the acquiring entity. In this particular case, while we have a deemed sale, that sale takes place on the acquired or the target. And the target cannot qualify for Rev Proc 2011-29 treatment in the view of the national office. Therefore, they must capitalize everything except those items that they can specifically show did not facilitate the transaction. That's a much tougher situation to meet. Okay. Now, went a little too far if you're watching on the video and the slides. Let's go on to our next set. I skipped one there accidentally. We're going to go on to the case of Balot versus Commissioner, Tax Memorandum Decision 2016-113. This is a case related to divorce. Now, as we're all aware, divorces are messy. Things happen. We all have those situations. Taxpayers get involved in a divorce, and suddenly things are going on. In this particular case, what happened in this case of Balot versus Commissioner 2016-113, that was decided on the 13th of June, we had a couple who, in addition to being married, were both involved in running a business. Now, as part of the divorce, they decided, which seemed to make sense to them at the time, although most of us would cringe and decide we could see how this could go wrong, they decided they would continue to operate the businesses as equal owners. So they're divorcing, they're breaking up the marriage, but we're going to go ahead and continue to be partners in the business. Not surprisingly, a little bit later, about a year later, the parties are at each other's throats. The ex-wife sues the ex-husband to have him kicked out of the business. And essentially, they eventually come to an agreement where the ex-wife buys out the ex-husband. So the ex-wife signs a contract paying on a note to the ex-husband. The ex-husband takes the position that this is not a sale of the interest that would be taxable, but rather under the general rules of Section 1041, I should say, that this is a transfer incident to a divorce. 1041A provides we recognize no gain or loss on a transfer incident to a divorce, and there's going to be a straight carryover basis to the other side. Now, in this case, general rule is under the regulation 1.1041-1TB, question and answer number 7, the general rule, they point out, that a transfer is incident to a divorce, generally if it occurs not more than, 6 years after the divorce is going to be the presumption, and it's pursuant to a divorce or separation instrument. Now, the divorce or separation instrument is the issue the IRS got concerned with. They said, wait, this sale's not contained in the instrument. The tax court points out that the regulation, while it says a transfer not pursuant to a divorce or separation instrument, any transfer occurring more than 6 years after the cessation of the marriage is presumed to not be related to the cessation of the marriage, is simply that a presumption. The IRS said, well, yeah, but all the examples we get of something that was more, they're examples of things that are 8-9 years later, and they all were pursuant to the agreement. And the tax court said, well, that's merely examples. Nothing in the reg says that you have to have it in the instrument. Merely not having it there creates a presumption. The court ruled that, hey, guys, let's be honest. This particular redemption arose directly from the fact of the divorce. The parties simply were not getting along. It's part of the problems continuing from the divorce. Therefore, the tax court found that this taxpayer could treat that as not a sale of the assets in the divorce. So that means he recognizes no gain or loss. Probably the bad news on the other side is, though the IRS didn't have this party in court, the other spouse would technically have the carryover basis. And since he's fighting, I'm going to presume there's a gain here, which means they're going to presume that to the wife, there is now effectively lost basis that she will not see. It's considered just be a property settlement. Next up, let's take a look at Private Letter Ruling 2016-24003 issued on June 12th. In this case, we have a S corporation that needed to go for a private letter ruling to establish that it has a valid S election. Because here's the problem. This was an LLC that elected or tried to elect to be taxed as an S corporation. LLCs can do that. There's no problem with that. However, under the regulations, they can only make such an election to be an S corporation that will convert them from their presumed role, which would be either disregard entity or a partnership. In this case, partnership would have been it because we have multiple owners, if they are otherwise eligible to be an S corp. Well, in this case, there's a problem, and this is a problem we often see with these LLC operating agreements if you're going to try to take them as an S-corp. LLC operating agreement boilerplate, by definition, normally most boilerplate operating agreements with LLCs assume the entity will be taxed as a partnership. That's just the way we expect this to run. The problem with that is it causes issues for us with the one class of stock rule. The one class of stock rule says basically this. We have to have identical rights in liquidation and for distributions. Under the standard rules that we'll see in boilerplate, good boilerplate for a LLC operating as a partnership, we're going to have references specifically to the maintenance of capital accounts under 704B and the strict rules on paying out any liquidation proceeds strictly with regard to the capital accounts. Now, while it's very likely that will result in the same per share, per interest, same distributions per interest as it would otherwise, and if our distributions also say they can be made that way, It doesn't have to. There are lots of situations that could cause that to change. They may be unusual, but they can happen. The mere fact they can happen, not that they are likely to or that they do, is enough to invalidate your S election. In this case, good news for the taxpayer. The IRS said, yep, taxpayer, we agree that's inadvertent. You didn't mean to. It's never actually made a difference. We're going to allow you to retroactively change your agreement and to go ahead and treat this as a valid S election from the first day. The bad news, if you are this taxpayer, is you had to pay for a private letter ruling. Private letter rulings are not inexpensive, and for all practical purposes, you know, they're kind of a pain to get. We prefer not to do it. What this really emphasizes for all of us, though, remember, these letter rulings do work, so we can get them. If you take on a new client, some states, for various reasons, it is popular to use an LLC as the base operating entity, even if you're going to make a corporate election. For instance, in some states, you have to make more public disclosures if you are a corporation than you do if you're a limited liability company. Well, some people like the privacy of that, so they want to be an LLC and then make the corporate tax election. Said all well and good, but you need to have an operating agreement that is drafted, assuming we're going to make an S election. Generally, that needs special language. If you inherit a client that is being taxed as an S corporation, but is doing so with an entity that is an LLC under state law, make sure you take a look at the operating agreement and make sure you consider, do we have a one class of stock problem? If we do, consider asking the taxpayer, you know, about going for a private letter ruling. In fact, if you have more than one class of stock, permits have to, or you got to tell them, well, you know, we can't file an S return. We have to either file a partnership return if you had multiple owners when you filed this, because your election would have been invalid. Your whole election would be a corporation would have been invalid if it's done with the 2553. Or do we file a C corp because your initial election was valid because you had one owner? One owner, there'll be by definition one class of stock. But we end up with the problem that, you know, down the line, we took on a second owner. That second owner, when we issued that stock, that's when suddenly we have two classes of stock. So we have to ask about that and go forward. Make sure you catch that right away. Finally, we'll take a look this week at our last case for the week. This case deals with the case of a Finnegan versus Commissioner Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2016-118. And this is when the tax court gets its first chance to look at a rule it put out forward in the Allen case a number of years ago, where it said that if a preparer is committing fraud and the preparer, in order to get customers, is preparing return, inventing deductions, and doing all kinds of fraudulent transactions or reported on returns, if that preparer is doing that, even if the taxpayer was unaware of the fraud, that return being fraudulent means the statute stays open forever. That particular position, first mentioned in the Allen case, was in the case of BASR. That was a federal circuit case. We had a very split panel that effectively, at least in one of the three judges, held that that position was ridiculous. You had to show fraud on the part of the taxpayer. A second judge concurred in result that the statute wasn't open, but suggested that it was because it was involved a partnership and a different code section than 6501, which is the one generally that governs statutes, was in play. And a third judge says, you're both wrong, the Allen decision is correct, and we should apply it. Well, this is the first chance the tax court had to revisit all of this after the BASR decision had come down last summer. And the tax court starts right off, and even though, and I think the parties knew this too, which is why nobody mentioned it, why Finnegan didn't mention it, the courts in a footnote right away says we see no reason to reconsider our decision in Allen. They note that in the federal circuit, it was a split decision. They found a persuasive dissent. I always find that funny with judges. Persuasive dissents means when they disagree with the decision. If there was a dissent, the dissent is always persuasive. But the court does properly point out that even in the decision, the majority decision that overturned the open statute, one of the two judges said it only applied because of the partnership. So the court said it's not clear, even if this case was to be appealable to the federal circuit, which it is not, that the federal circuit would rule it applied in this case. And secondly, the court pointed out, no tax court case is ever appealable to the federal circuit. So for all practical purposes, we don't really care what the federal circuit said. And we had the case in Citywide Transit where the tax court had at an appellate court that was one where its cases can be heard that had backed up the Allen decision. In fact, reversed Citywide Transit, sent it back to the tax court because they didn't follow the Allen decision. Well, in this case, the problem for this taxpayer was simple. They had used a bad preparer. The preparer, in fact, had pled guilty to preparation of fraudulent tax returns. And like a lot of fraudulent preparers, he had kind of, you know, always done the same thing. He, in fact, used the same numbers on many returns. So the taxpayer's returns, you had all those fake numbers, all the fake mechanisms, including false partnerships that were used. The tax court found that, sorry, Finnegan, your return is fraudulent. As such, the statute is totally open. So every year that that preparer prepared for you, the IRS can go back and assess tax against you. Not a good day for the Finnegans. Obviously, they would prefer a different result, but not surprising. And if anybody thought the tax court after BASR might change their view, answer is no, they're not changing their view here anytime soon. Well, remember, we are in CPE time. Your state society has a bunch of courses available to you. Be sure to go take a look at your state society's website for the courses that are related to your practice. We've got lots of things going on. We're now in full swing. This is a time of year to get your training together so that you can better serve your clients as we approach the tax planning part of the year later in the year. And as we approach a brand new tax season, lots of things have gone on this year. It's important to get yourself up to speed with what's happening. It's important to understand that, you know, the world doesn't stop. The tax world doesn't stop adding new cases, new rulings, and new requirements just because we're in tax season. It's important, therefore, for you to go ahead and go out and look to your state society's website for courses, whether they're the ones that we teach here at Nichols Patrick, or whether they're the ones that other vendors are teaching for your society. Be sure to take a look there at those courses. This has been the current federal tax developments for the week of June the 20th, 2016. Remember to go check our daily updates at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, www.currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, for those of you that like to put the triple W on the front. You can also download a PDF that will have all the articles related to today's presentation. Be sure to check your State Society of CPAs website for all of these full-day courses we've already mentioned. And if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me at edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can follow me on Twitter at edzollers. And by the way, on currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, if you want to get emails as we post the articles during the week describing tax developments, you can sign up for our daily email update at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. Well, take care. Have a good week. And we'll see you next week on Current Federal Tax Developments.